Tim Berenger is Paul Mellon Professor of the History of Art at Yale University. Eleanor Hughes is a postdoctoral research associate at the Yale Center for British Art, and together they have organized a comprehensive interdisciplinary project called Art and Music in Britain for Encounters, 1730 to 1900. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, you and your colleagues at Yale have taken on a pretty huge project here with so many facets that it's a little hard for me to even know where to start on this. But I think I'd like each of you to please describe the kind of the broad concept, the overview of what this project is about.
Well, perhaps I should start, since it's my crazy idea that really set the ball rolling several years ago when I taught a seminar with 12 Yale students called Art and Music in Britain from Plain Song to Punk. And so it was the most ridiculous attempt to deal with this wonderful theme between the music of the monasteries and the music of the late 20th century. And the energy generated by those students and the discussions that we had around the table, literally just throwing up slides and listening to music from that period, was what set me off on a very long research project, which is going to end up probably with a book written by me, but also with this wonderful collaboration with Eleanor Hughes and with colleagues from across Yale University. Because really what happened is that we decided that when I taught this seminar again, we would get together some objects to work with from the Yale collections. And the way things work in the university is that people's enthusiasm grows, and gradually this turned into a very substantial loan exhibition with musical instruments from the musical instrument collection, with rare books from the Yale Center for British Art and from the Beinecke Library, and with sheet music from the Yale Music Library, and also with loans, key loans from the Metropolitan Museum and from the Bodleian Library. And this has turned into a major exhibition, alongside which we're doing a series of concerts in which the music actually lives in the same building. So it's turned into a really major interdisciplinary festival, really.
Hmm. And Eleanor, how did you get sucked into this?
Well, I arrived at the center as a postdoctoral research associate last October, and was assigned to a number of different projects in various capacities, one of which was to go and be point person for Tim, since he teaches in the History of Art department, and to basically be a kind of a runner for him, which quickly evolved into being asked to co-curate.
And I should say that Eleanor is an expert on the 18th century, and my field is really the late 18th and 19th century. So we're both art historians by training rather than musicologists. So we put together our expertise, and then we brought in the expertise of other colleagues from around Yale. And it's become a kind of collective project which has no single author, which has been the fun part of it.
Hmm. Now, I want to sort of veer off on a very minor tangent here, because you said that this originally began with a course called Plain Song to Punk. And I have to ask, what's the personal interest, particularly because you're telling me that music is not necessarily your main field of expertise? What is your interest? I have this image of you being in sort of secretly into punk music or something.
Well, that's an interesting image. Unfortunately, my tweed jacket might rather put you off that thought. But certainly, I could personally say that whereas art history has been my life, really my professional life, music has always been my sort of personal passion. And it's a dangerous thing in a way to mix together those two. But of course, by raising the psychological stakes by putting the thing that you love most in the classroom with all the other sort of professional things that you've learned how to do, historical analysis and visual analysis, it actually led to this sort of, for me, very, very creative fusion of the things that I used to do, you know, on the weekend and the things that I used to do in the week. And I found that tremendously appealing. I may say, a failed French horn player. And as a result of that, there is a most glorious French horn in the first exhibition of the room, which I look at longingly and wish I could play, but I can't. So I'll do an exhibition about it instead.
Hmm. Tell me about that instrument.
Well, this is a magnificent early 19th century open horn with no valves. It's from just the moment before the valve horn was invented. And the marvelous thing about it is it comes from the Yale collection of musical instruments. It's actually made in France, but it's the kind that was played in England. And beneath it, we have arrayed a number of prints which represent music making at Vauxhall Gardens. And in many of them, you can see just this kind of trompe de chasse being played, this this wonderful loop of a horn in which the chromatics were made by moving the right hand in the bell. And of course now early music specialists are again playing this kind of horn. And of course the sound is quite different from a modern orchestral horn. And one of the fun things about the exhibition is that we have in each room we have a little listening station where you can listen to 2-minute extracts of some of the music that's depicted. So, for example, we have music from Vauxhall Gardens, and we have Handel's music for the Royal Fireworks on the recordings. And in the cases, we've actually got the original score, the original parts for the music for the Royal Fireworks, and also a wonderful portrait of Handel by Houbraken. And one of the decorative elements in the frieze around the face of this, frankly, not particularly beautiful-looking man, is a glorious representation of a horn almost identical to the one that's hanging above it. So, frankly, we had tremendous fun matching up the real objects, the real musical instruments, with representations of them.
Now, the thing that I find really captivating about this project is that you're not really necessarily presenting anything new, but you're really, as you say, sort of grouping these materials, and you're really looking at these very familiar things that are right there in various collections on the campus, but you're really looking at them through a different lens. And I'm wondering how common it is to work across disciplines in this way.
Well, I think it's very unusual for an exhibition to accommodate all these different kinds of objects around a central theme. One might go to an exhibition of historical musical instruments. One can certainly see a great collection of paintings every day at the Yale Center for British Art, and we often have loan exhibitions of works on paper, which include books. We recently had a wonderful show called Searching for Shakespeare, which did something quite similar. But it's the living dimension. It's having the musical sound available on headphones and having the musical instruments there that I think is new. But one of the wonderful things, too, has been to take works from our collection, which are on permanent view to the public and very familiar to our students at Yale and to the general public in New Haven and people who visit from all over the world, such as, say, Turner's painting of Staffa, Fingal's Cave, which is one of the great highlights of the collection, and to put it in a completely new context by surrounding it with objects connected with Mendelssohn's overture. I'm sure all your listeners will be familiar with the overture Fingal's Cave, which was premiered in London, 1832, the same year that Turner's painting hung on the walls of the Royal Academy, and to put the original letter from Mendelssohn to his parents, in which he actually writes down for the first time that famous opening theme, which reminds you of the waves rolling in onto the shore. We've borrowed that letter from New York Public Library. It's hanging next to the painting, and so you see that painting in a completely new context with the Mendelssohn around it.
Well, let's focus on the first of the four encounters, and that is George Frederick Handel's London from the 1730s to the 1750s. And my first question about this is specifically why Handel's London rather than some other, you know, important fixture from the 18th century?
Well, I think we chose Handel's London because, A, Handel was the predominant musical figure during the period in London. As you'll know, he spent most of his life in London and produced many of his great works there. But it also enabled us to use Handel as to focus on the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens as a place where art and music specifically came together during that period in London.
Okay. And what are some of the highlights of this particular part of the project, part one?
Well, I should say that at the center of the Vauxhall Gardens was this tremendous marble statue of Handel by French sculptor Louis-François Roubilliac. And it was specifically put there because the proprietor of the gardens, these are pleasure gardens where you would pay a shilling and go in and eat your supper and listen to music. The proprietor had made a concerted effort to raise the status of the gardens. They had been open in the 17th century but had fallen into disrepute. And he reopened the gardens in 1732 and wanted to make sure that they were a place where polite society could come and listen to music and behave in a civilized manner. And the figure of Handel presiding over the gardens makes that very clear, in that he's seen as a figure, he's seen as the embodiment of Orpheus. He's holding a lyre, and he's leaning on a stack of musical scores of his own composition, One of which is one of his most recent successes, Alexander's Feast, which is all about the power of music to sway the emotions and specifically to civilize otherwise potentially unruly crowds. So Jonathan Tyers, the proprietor, was very concerned to give the gardens this air of respectability by having the figure of Handel at its center. And then you see in the exhibition this statue reappearing in different views of Vauxhall.
Hmm. What's some of the music that is being featured, and how did you choose it?
For the first bay?
For the first part, yeah.
We have featured music that was specifically composed, we think, for performance at Vauxhall, including a work by James Hook, which is called Wine, Wine is the Cordial, and is typical of the types of songs that were performed at the gardens by professional musicians. And we have a songbook borrowed from the Beinecke Library that's open to display the song, and it says by James Hook and as performed by a singer at the Vauxhall Gardens. And we have an example of a song by another British composer who we believe that Tyers commissioned composers to write songs specifically for performance at Vauxhall. And another one of the great composers, Thomas Arne, is featured in our listening stations, singing a song that is known to have been performed at Vauxhall as well. And we also featured the Handel Fireworks music, which I think Tim mentioned earlier was actually rehearsed at Vauxhall.
And what are some of the other art and performances that are part of the Handel's London section of the exhibit?
Well, what we really wanted to do was to draw attention to one of the great works in the Centre's collection, which is William Hogarth's painting of the first production of The Beggar's Opera by John Gay, this amazing document in which one of the main themes of the exhibition comes to the fore, and that theme is the relationship between high and low, between elite culture and popular culture in England. Every room of this exhibition has really at least two voices in it. One is the voice of the sort of the grand opera, the symphony, the elite patrons, the grand music, and also that's represented in art by things like history painting and very expensive engravings. But we've also got the sounds of the street. We have a wonderful collection of ballads, which were these very ephemeral little slips of paper, which had words printed on them with a little emblem, usually a little woodcut as well. And the words you'd sing along to popular songs, it's just tunes that you already knew. So that was the sound of the street. Now, the wonderful thing about The Beggar's Opera is that it actually transposed those songs of the street, those sounds of popular culture, onto the operatic stage as a kind of correction to or a satire of the elaborate Italian operas that Handel himself was promoting in London at the time. So what you can hear is, as you walk into the room, you can see Vauxhall Gardens and you can see representations of grand opera in the Handelian and continental tradition. And then you can hear a blast of Cockney realism coming through with the Beggar's Opera, where, after all, the hero is a highwayman. And you hear wonderful sounds of everyday 18th century London. And we've represented that particularly through the artist William Hogarth, because Hogarth was able, through his creed of a kind of satirical, raunchy realism, to overturn the aspirations of English artists simply to imitate the traditions of history painting and allegory that were coming basically from a continental tradition. So Hogarth's a breath of wonderful English fresh air at the beginning of the show.
I'm curious to know about the actual performances. I know you have the listening stations, but there are some live performances that are taking place as part of this project. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, yes. And in fact, the performances are scheduled to accompany the seminar that I'm teaching jointly with my colleague Margot Fassler, who is a medievalist from the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. So she's able to handle the plain song end of things, and I'm sort of vaguely dealing with the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So that's the way we've split it up. So we started with a wonderful recital of Tudor lute music and English airs sung by the English tenor James Gilchrist with Elizabeth Kenny, the lutenist, accompanying him. And the way we connected that to the issue of art is actually work from earlier period than is in the exhibition. But I gave a short talk on the English miniature, of which we have examples in the collection, and the idea of these wonderful little tiny paintings, which, like these 2 or 3 minute songs, seem to be able to encapsulate a whole world into a very tiny, tiny form. And we're going to work through with a series of nine, altogether nine concerts, working through the 18th century with a recital given by the harpsichord player, Nicholas McGeegan, who will be giving a recital with soloists from the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. And we'll be working through to 20th century music in the spring with Elgar, Walton, Benjamin Britten, and then the contemporary composer Brian Fernyhough will be coming to speak about his music in the spring.
So you've really reached well beyond just the resources right there on campus.
Yes, we have, we've been bringing people in from all over the world. But the great thing is that all the visiting musicians will be working with Yale students while they're at the university. So it's kind of a collaboration. And actually, next Wednesday, I'll be giving a lecture on the aesthetic movement, in which the voice program of the Yale Institute for Sacred Music will be stepping outside their usual repertoire to do extracts from Gilbert and Sullivan's opera Patience, which is a satire on Victorian aesthetes. So we've got a nice mixture of international stars and the Yale students who hopefully will be the stars of tomorrow.
Now, you mentioned this is pretty much an undergrad seminar, is that correct? Not a graduate level?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. But it's very clear that this is intended to reach well beyond just the Yale community in terms of the people that come and attend and enjoy this. Who do you want? Who are you really hoping to bring onto campus, to bring into this project?
Well, this project should have the widest possible reach. We have a tremendous education program at the Yale Center for British Art, in which every school kid in New Haven comes at least once or twice to the center to in some way or another to connect with the collection. So the building is always full of young people from the area. We also get people visiting from all over the world, and we try to connect with the Yale community, but also with New Haven and with, in fact, anyone on the East Coast who wants to come and participate. So the idea is not that it's an inward-looking seminar, but that the teaching is kind of the dynamo at the center, if you like, which then generates ideas which can be shared as widely as possible.
We should also mention in that respect that there is also a website which mentions which includes on it every object that is in the show and all of the text that's been generated in relation to those objects, which is available, of course, worldwide. So,
and you're going to give us the website.
It is artandmusic.yale.edu.
Oh, okay. And I'm curious to know whether, because it sounds as though this is very successful so far, do you envision future collaborations of this kind? And what might they be?
Well, of course, I'm dying to get my hands on the 20th century because this set of encounters, and we deliberately said four encounters. This is only four out of numerous potential encounters. And I think it will be really fascinating to pursue this whole question of art and music into 20th century Britain. After all, the English musical Renaissance, so-called, with Elgar and his contemporaries and Vaughan Williams, Holst, names that are really familiar, only occurred really right at the end of the period that we've studied in this particular project. So I think it will be wonderful to look at the ways. For example, I discovered that Benjamin Britten was a really major collector of paintings, and so his own tastes as a musician. He was interested in Sidney Nowell, and he was interested in neo-romantic landscapes by Paul Nash and John Nash. And he was a man of very sophisticated connection with artists like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth. So I would love to see this project move into the 20th century and even into the contemporary era, because after all, this is a very dynamic moment for art and for music in Britain right now. And I think it would be great to actually stage in the United States some of those new works that are coming out of London right now.
Do you imagine that this, in any way, this art and music in Britain, the four encounters that you're working on right now, do you envision that this could travel?
We don't have plans to travel the exhibition in its present form because it's so much been created from Yale resources. But I would love to see in the future a reconstituted version to travel around. Some of the objects are very fragile, but still it would be great to share it with communities elsewhere, not least in Britain, of course, where this has never been tried.
Hmm. And how long is this particular installation going to be available for people to come and see and hear?
I think it closes on the 31st of December, the exhibition, but that there will be performances running right through the spring term, so until April. And actually, just by chance, there is a wonderful conclusion to our whole year of events, which is that the massed Yale forces in April will be performing the Britain War Requiem. So there will be a kind of grandiose celebration of 20th century British music right at the end of the spring semester in April.
Well, Tim Berenger and Eleanor Hughes, I want to thank you very much for making time to chat with me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.